So I want you to start by thinking about the town where you were born. Not where you grew up, because that's not always the same thing, is it? Yeah? Some of you may have grown up in Caterham, but you probably weren't born in Caterham. Red Hill, maybe, in the hospital there or something like that, okay? So, quick table discussion. I want you to tell me where you were born and something interesting about that town. So the most interesting thing you can come up with about the town you were actually born in. Off you go. Table discussions. So we'll just have a quick go round, see what people have got on your table. Have you got anything where you were born, anything interesting?
Yeah, I was born.
Hold on, be quiet.
I was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and Kingston, Jamaica has the most church per capita in the world.
Fantastic! Whoa, good to hear. I like that one. That's really good. I think we should have gone with your law, because I think that's better. Go on then, who else got? Who else has got? Place where they're born and something interesting.
I was born in Worcester, which is Tottenham's got being one of the places of cerebral associated.
And that's exactly what my mind went to when you said Worcester, not the source in any shape at all. No.
Well, I've heard of that.
Anywhere else? Yeah? Yes?
I'm born in 2009.
Born in Caterham. Actually in Caterham. Just down the road. Fantastic. Very good. Yeah?
I was born at home in Caterham, down the road.
Unbelievable. The trouble is, can anybody think of an interesting fact about Caterham? Apart from the fact, I think we had the very first bypass in the world.
Formula One.
There we go.
What?
So.
Formula One.
Formula One. Okay, so. I will be honest here. Generally, there's nothing special about where you were born in terms of you. Where you were born doesn't decide the rest of your life. Where you grew up, maybe so. But where you're born, physically the location, you know, the hospital or whatever, nobody makes decisions on your life based upon that. Yeah? You have to have it on your birth certificate, but when you're applying, I don't know, for a job, they don't go, which town were you born in? Because we don't want anybody from Red Hill. You know, kind of thing. That basically where you were born, unless you're a cricketer, because basically Yorkshire Cricket Club basically said you had to be born in Yorkshire for many years before you could play for Yorkshire. Unless you're a cricketer, really it has little impact upon your life. So, question. Why is it so important that Jesus is born in Bethlehem? It's just a place. What's the significance of Jesus having to be born in Bethlehem? And you're going to go, oh, yeah, but obviously that's to fulfill the prophecy. Well, hang on, wait a second. Wouldn't it have been a lot easier if God had simply said, the Messiah will be born in Nazareth? It would have saved Mary and Joseph a whole journey. Yeah? They wouldn't have had to go all the way south. Jesus could just have been born in Nazareth and the prophecy would have come true. But no, there's something significant about Bethlehem. It's clear that God has organised it so that Mary and Joseph have to travel all the way back to Bethlehem, where he comes from. And he's got to go back there because Jesus has to be born there. And the timings all work out. So why? What is so significant about Bethlehem? Now, Bethlehem itself, even back then, was relatively unimportant. It wasn't a big town. It didn't have a wall. Certainly when we hear about attacks coming into Israel, they talk about the walled cities. Bethlehem wasn't mentioned. It's not on a trade route. It's about 8 miles from Jerusalem. It's first mentioned in the book of Genesis. So in the book of Genesis, basically Rachel, which is Jacob's wife, she dies and is buried on the way to Ephrath. That is Bethlehem, as it says. So that's kind of like the first mention of Bethlehem. And then we don't hear much about it until Ruth comes along. So the book of Ruth, okay? Naomi has a husband, 2 sons, there's a big famine, she leaves, she goes to Moab, and she lives there for a number of years. And when she's in Moab, her husband dies, her sons die, and she decides to come back with her daughters-in-law. One of them says she's going to stay, one comes back with her, which is Ruth, and they come back to Bethlehem. She marries Boaz. If you remember the story, Boaz owns the field. She goes out, she gathers up the grain in the fields. Boaz sees her, marries her.
her great-grandson? King David. King David. Okay, the king that all of the Israelites have heard of, the king that all of the Israelites hold up in awe, King David, is born there. And so ever after, that place is known as the town of David. And that's part of his significance. It's that link with David. You know, he is Israel's greatest king. In the book of Luke, when Luke is describing about Jesus and Jesus being born, he says, Joseph was of the house and the line of David. He's linking him back to David. But why is David so important? Why is it important to link Jesus with David? Because David has a link with the Messiah, the anointed one, the promised one who's going to come, who all of Israel are waiting for. Book of 2 Samuel, okay? God is talking with David. He's talking through his prophet, but he talks to David and he says about his descendant. And he says, there is a descendant coming. He is the one who will build a house for my name. I'll establish the throne of his kingdom forever. This won't be an ordinary king. Nobody has a kingdom forever. Your house, your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. He keeps talking about this everlasting king who's going to be coming along. The one who will restore the relationship with God. The one who will save God's people. That message of God saving and redeeming his people goes all the way back. You look at Egypt, you look at the promised land. You look at all those situations where Israel has been in trouble and God steps in and says, I am here to save you when you are in trouble, when you're in difficulty. And that's that link going back to God's anointed one. God is going to save. And that's particularly relevant for the people who lived in Micah's time. You see, we always look at these prophecies and we go, okay, when we read this out in our carol services, we always read it out, yeah, and we don't put the context in there. And I always go, no, you've got to understand the context of when a passage was written. So what was going on when Micah was writing this? In 1939, Hitler swept across Europe, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Denmark, Norway, Luxembourg, Belgium and France all just fell just like that. The only thing that stopped Hitler sweeping through the British Isles was the fact that we were an island. And we had a sea in the way because he swept everybody before him. And back in Micah's time, there was a similar situation. There was a nation that lived to the north of Israel called the Assyrians. They were brutal. We talk about the Americans doing, what is it, shock and awe, they say. Let people see our amazing systems and go, wow, like that. Well, the Assyrians did shock and horror. They said, if you rebel against us, we will come down on you so hard that no one will ever dare rebel again. And they would pile up the skulls outside the gates of the cities that they raised to rabble. And this lot invaded from the north. They'd already done it before. Israel is 12 tribes. There have been 10 tribes in the north called Israel and 2 tribes in the south called Judah. And the 10 tribes had gone against God and God had brought down judgment on them in the form of the Assyrians and they come down, swept through the northern area and wiped it out. And those 10 tribes, they just vanished from history. We never hear from them again. And now the Assyrians are going to do the same to the 2 at the bottom, to Judah and to Benjamin, and they come sweeping down south. And they sack the cities all around. They run rampant. In fact, the Assyrians record this themselves in their own records. People go, oh, this stuff is only just in the Bible. Where's the proof? The Assyrians actually write it down about how they came south and stormed through the land, and they lay siege to Jerusalem. And when we read in our carol services these lovely verses about Bethlehem, the context is that the land is being sacked around the people hearing that promise. The land is being destroyed. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you're small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be a ruler over Israel, whose origins are from of old, from ancient times. You see, right in the middle of that passage where he's talking about marshal your troops now, city your troops, for a siege is laid against us in verse 1. Right in the middle of that, God makes a promise. I'm not going to abandon my people. Okay, you're not given up. You think the world is set against you? It's not, because I am on your side. And there will be a Messiah coming. You look back to David. You're terrified. The Assyrians are coming in from the north, and you think, if only we had a king like David. If only we had a king like David who could drive them out. And he's saying, look, there will come a king, my anointed king, in my time, and he'll be born in Bethlehem, in the little town of Bethlehem. He'll bring God's people together. Verse 4, he'll stand and shepherd his flock. He'll have the strength of the Lord, majesty in the name of the Lord. He will be God's anointed one, and he will bring them, bring God's people to a secure place where they will live. And they will reach to the ends of the earth. Basically, in the midst of everything that's going on, God turns around and says, this is not the end. I'll make a promise to you. I have my plans for you. And my anointed, my Messiah, will come and save his people. You know, it's interesting. The Bible tells us what happened with that Assyrian invasion. In fact, even the king, the Assyrian king, wrote about it. He said, oh, I trapped Hezekiah the king in Jerusalem. I trapped him there. No, basically what you're saying is you didn't manage to get into Jerusalem, which is precisely what happened. He got around Jerusalem, surrounded it, laid siege to it, but God intervenes. God intervenes and saves that city. Hezekiah, the king, is safe. The Assyrian army retreat and give up their attack. And so the people reading this prophecy must have wondered what on earth was going on. Maybe going round to Micah and going, Micah, what on earth are you going on about Bethlehem? Where did that figure in all of this retreat? Where is this prophecy there? I don't understand. And maybe even Micah himself was confused, but the reason is actually, this is all part of God's long-term plan. This is what God is working out. So look, you've had a table discussion already on a kind of less serious note. Let's have a serious one. On your tables, discuss this. Which of these two is it easier to understand? God's long-term plan for all humanity, for all mankind, that God is in charge of everything, or that God has plans for you? So, big, small. Is it easier to understand that God has massive, great big plans for the whole of the universe, for everything, or is it easier to understand that God has plans for us? Have a chat on your table. Let me start over there. Have you got anything? Do you think it's easier when you think about God's large plans or God's small plans for us?
I said large plans. Yeah. I think it's a lot more easier to think that God had this plan getting carried out through a bunch of people than what God's got carried out to me is about what God wants you, because you never really know what God wants you to do.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Archie. Anybody else?
I agree with him.
Yeah?
I'm happy to agree.
Any other view? Anybody struggling?
I'm not agreeing with him, and then Sharon came up with it. He said that if you've got a big plan, then you can have a
small plan. You've got to have a big plan with a small plan.
Yeah.
To make sure the big plan is
happening. Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. Yeah?
That's how the area depends.
Yeah. And maybe that's where we struggle, is I think with the small plans, is we're thinking, how can God keep his eye on all these little things when he's got this big plan going on? It is really difficult. But part of this passage teaches us exactly that God has this huge, great plan. Okay, this is all part of his divine agenda, his divine plan. It literally would have meant nothing to the people at that time, and they must have literally been saying to Micah, what on earth is going on? And Micah going, I'm pretty certain God has a purpose for this. When he asked me to prophesy about Bethlehem, I'm pretty certain God had something in mind. So this is all part of God's divine agenda. He's demonstrating that he keeps his promises. Part of the reason why Jesus was born in Bethlehem is because God had said that would happen. And he wants to show that he keeps his promises. Okay? He's come to save. And the fact that Jesus is born in Bethlehem basically shows that God started way, way back with Ruth. And then with David. And then with the prophecies, with Micah and other prophecies that came through. And then finally up to Jesus, God is saying, look, I keep my word. I've been telling you this is going to happen all the way along. But when Jesus turns up, you go, well, of course he was going to be born in Bethlehem. It makes all the sense in the world now. This is God's plan for his people. And for me, that's really encouraging. Because when we look at the world at times, we think, is there a plan? And God says, yes, there is. And you can see it from my word, that there is God's plan for all humanity that reaches from the beginning of time to the end. But, having said that, I could probably have picked almost any passage in the Bible to give you that message. The idea that God has a plan is probably preached, on average, I should think, every other sermon that we do, because it's a really easy application to go, yeah, God has a plan. But there's something else we get from this one, which I really like. Is that God is the God of the small things too. You know, Bethlehem's not important. It's not big. It's not special. Surely it would have been far easier for God to say that his future anointed king, that his special chosen one would be born in Jerusalem, the capital city. But God turns around and says, no, Bethlehem is important, even though it's small. There is a lovely passage in Zechariah. I did a children's talk on this years and years ago on Zechariah, and there was someone in the church at the time who was quite small, and I checked it out with them first and said, am I okay talking about this? And she went, yeah, I really like that passage actually. Because this passage says this: who dares despise the day of small things? Who dares despise the day of small things? Since the seven eyes of the Lord that range through the earth will rejoice. Okay? And God says, look, actually, don't despise the small things. God turns around and says, yeah, Bethlehem isn't important. It's not big. It's not special. But to me, it is. You look at it with your human eyes and you just see a dirty little town. I see Bethlehem. Somewhere special. And I love that because, do you know what? I don't feel special at all at times. And I'm pretty certain when I look around this room that at times all of us feel the same way. We're not important. In the great scheme of things, we are just a small church that meets in Caterham Valley. We enjoy each other's company, but we're not going to change the world and things like that. Maybe some of the youngsters will. Fantastic, go ahead and do it. But sadly, you get to my age, you realise you're never going to be in the Olympics. And the bit is that's not a problem for God. Paul writes about that. Paul says to the Corinthians, he says, brothers and sisters, think of what you were when you were called, meaning when you became Christians. Not many of you were wise by human standards, not many were influential, not many were of noble birth, but God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. See, God takes those little things and he uses them. He used Bethlehem, this insignificant little town, and he says, I will take Bethlehem and I will use it for my purposes. And I know that he can do the same with me. And I know that he can do the same with each and every one of us in this room who choose to follow him. You see, God is strong when we're weak. And that's why I like Bethlehem, because it is small and insignificant and weak. And yet God chooses to work through it. But there's a third thing about Bethlehem, which I just want to tell you. I like names in the Bible, and typically because names mean something in the Bible. So you get Elijah, which is made up of that El bit and the Yah bit, which means God, El, is the Lord, or the Lord is God. That's what Elijah's name literally means. And that's his ministry. Elijah goes round telling people that the Lord is God. Joshua, the one who brings God's people into the promised land, his name, the Yah bit, is God's name, Yahweh again. And the Shah bit is God saves. So literally, the Lord saves. And that's what he's showing when he brings the people into the promised land. Micah, okay, who we've been reading about. Micah's name, who is like God? Who is like the Lord is Micah's name. So do you know what Bethlehem means? Bethlehem means the house of bread. the house of bread. I'm guessing there were great fields of wheat around there. We know obviously that, you know, that Ruth returned, Naomi came back there for the harvest and things like that. And you can imagine that you came out from Bethlehem, there were fields of wheat out there, and they baked obviously really good bread there. It was known as a house of bread, and bread was vitally important back then. Every meal you'd have bread with it because it sustained life. You may have some vegetables, possibly a bit of meat, but you always had some bread. And Jesus, when he stands up to describe how he has come to sustain God's people, what does he say? I am the bread of life. I'm the bread of life. There's a preacher, Jennifer Slattery, and she wrote this wonderful sentence on this. She said, based upon this verse, she said, God sent the Prince of Peace to give us peace. The bread of life birthed in the house of bread to give us life from now to eternity. You see, Jesus sustains us, brings us life. He is the bread of life. And part of that is he is fulfilling God's promise, and he is born in the house of bread as a reminder of what he came to do. Look, you're going to hear about Bethlehem a lot over the next couple of weeks. It's going to come up all the time. In all of your readings and the songs and the hymns that we're going to do, Bethlehem will come up. So three things to remember. Number one, Bethlehem reminds us of God's divine eternal plan. Okay, the big plan, the great plan that says, I am in charge and in control. But Bethlehem also reminds us that God cares about the small things, the things that we consider are insignificant. Yeah, and yet God cares about them as well. And thirdly, that the bread of life came from the house of bread. We're going to be celebrating communion in a moment. We're going to take that bread and eat it and remind ourselves of Jesus' death and his resurrection for us. And as we take that bread, let's remind ourselves that the bread of life fulfilled God's promise by being born in Bethlehem, the house of bread. Amen.